It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, we'll talk to a state lawmaker who's proposing a bill that would help ease the burden of student debt for people who commit to farming in Wisconsin.
First, it's our weekly look at the latest in national politics with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.
Iowa continues to dominate the news as Donald Trump claims that the Cruz campaign may have tried to disrupt the Carson campaign.
And the presidential field is getting smaller as multiple candidates are leaving the race after disappointing performances in Iowa, and endorsements are starting to filter in as we get closer to New Hampshire.
Harry Enten joins us now. Hi, Harry.
Hello.
Well, if I've learned nothing else from you, Harry, I have learned over the last couple of weeks that Iowa is really hard to predict in polling. How true did that turn out to be this year?
Well, let's just say that Donald Trump led in every single poll that came out in the final few weeks before the Iowa caucus. And he, as he might say, is a loser. He lost, obviously, so the polls did not get that correct, though I will say that there were a few polls right near the very end which showed him dropping off, with Cruz rising and Rubio especially rising. So they caught the momentum, and in the past, candidates supported by Christian conservatives like Ted Cruz had underperformed. So this was not a shocking result, but clearly the polls were off.
And one of your colleagues at 538 said the moral of the story in Iowa is keep polling until they start caucusing. The only reliable numbers are maybe the ones that come out, you know, as close as possible to the actual event itself.
That's exactly right, because keep in mind, most voters are not like people like myself who are paying attention to this campaign from the start to the beginning. They continue to take in information. And while we argue about how conservative or anti-establishment these candidates are, the ideological difference between them is much smaller than the difference between, say, Ted Cruz and Hillary Clinton than it is between Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. So voters can shift between these candidates, and apparently they did.
Now, following these results, we've seen the field get narrower. Huckabee and O'Malley out first, and now today Senator Rand Paul, and then Rick Santorum expected to be out. First of all, there was a case that if they couldn't make it in Iowa, they couldn't make it anywhere for those candidates?
Yeah, I mean, basically Iowa was the perfect state for someone like Mike Huckabee or Rick Santorum. It's, you know, a lot of Christian conservatives. It's very conservative overall. So if they couldn't win there, they weren't going to win anywhere. And, I mean, Martin O'Malley has been loaning himself money. I honestly am shocked that he stayed in as long as he did. I guess he thought, hey, maybe something might happen between now and the caucuses, but nothing happened. I expect that more people will drop out after the New Hampshire result, whereby you have people like Chris Christie, John Kasich, Jeb Bush, especially Kasich and Christie, who have basically bet their entire campaign on New Hampshire. And if they can't do well there, then they'll probably drop off too.
Right, but those are candidates who didn't expect to do well in Iowa, so it would be really surprising if they dropped out between Iowa and New Hampshire.
That's exactly right. Remember, there are some candidates like Santorum and Huckabee who basically bet everything on Iowa because the demographics and the ideology lined up best for them, and when it was clear that they couldn't do well in a state that they should be able to do well in, if they want to have any shot at the nomination, they decided to pack it up.
Talking about the week in politics, national politics with Harry Enten from 538.com. So Ted Cruz wins first place in Iowa after the caucus. Donald Trump, who we've talked about a little bit here and there, Harry.
Not just a little.
Gracious in his concession speech. Now on Twitter today, accusing Cruz of stealing Iowa. Here's a quote from one tweet. Ted Cruz didn't win Iowa. He stole it. That is why all of the polls were so wrong. Why he got far more votes than anticipated. Bad. There was an earlier version of the tweet with the word illegally in it. That went out. He took that out. So not a gracious second place. He's saying, hey, let's invalidate this, do over, something like that. So more what we might have expected from a second place Donald Trump?
I think that these tweets lined up, and I want to be very clear what Trump is full of it. There was nothing illegal that happened. Ted Cruz won this fair and square. We could argue about whether or not Iowa should have gone first, or maybe a state that was friendlier to Trump, but Iowa does go first. I'm not really quite sure what Trump is doing. Is he A, just trying to draw more media attention to him and suck all the oxygen out? B, is he just like a five-year-old at Kmart who didn't get the candy that he wanted? I'm not really sure. I can just say that it is very sweet for some of us who have been claiming all along that a loss for Trump would bring him down to size, and apparently it has.
The allegation that the Cruz campaign spread misleading information that Ben Carson was going to drop out, then the Ben Carson voters went to Cruz. But as I understand it, Carson actually outperformed his polling.
That's exactly right. Carson did better than the polling averages suggested. And it wasn't just that Cruz said this. This was reported by major media that basically got it a little bit wrong. But Cruz was just passing along information. And even if he, quote-unquote, made it up, there's nothing illegal about that. Maybe, you know, that's for voters to decide whether they think Cruz should get punished, but there's nothing illegal.
Democratic side, razor-thin margin there. Some Sanders supporters saying, hey, these coin tosses, there's something fishy about that. The coin tosses, and maybe you can clarify this, didn't mean what people thought they meant, it sounds like.
Right. There are basically two things that are going on here. First off, we don't actually know how many coin tosses happened. These happened when they were trying to decide who should get this final delegate of the county convention delegates that would go to the county convention. Those are different than what is being reported by the media who wins and loses. Those are statewide equivalent delegates. It's a very confusing thing, but essentially the coin toss has decided something much more minor. There are a lot more county delegates than there are statewide delegates, so these shifted pretty much nothing, even in light of the fact that the result was so close. This was even smaller than the margin, almost certainly, and more than that, there were a ton of coin tosses that went against Hillary Clinton. It just those weren't reported as much, but the statewide party has at least told us about those that have been recorded of the state of the coin tosses, that a bunch went against Clinton as well.
New Hampshire is around the corner. Candidates are already there stumping. Now let's talk about Jeb Bush. Could be faltering there as well. Here's a clip of a speech he gave yesterday.
I think the next president needs to be a lot quieter, but send a signal that we're prepared to act in the national security interests of this country to get back in the business of creating a more peaceful world. Please clap.
So, please clap there. That's been making the rounds. Two people claiming to be paid seat fillers for Bush protesting at an event, though there's rumors that they might have been a plant. But, you know, apart from the polling, the narrative is not going well for Jeb Bush.
No, I went to a few of his events in Iowa. He is a serious politician with serious policy proposals, whether or not you agree with them. And it's kind of, you know, sad watching this old guy who most people would agree be a successful governor go out and basically asking for applause. He did quite poorly in Iowa. This is despite Right to Rise's super PAC spending so much money on the air for him and against Marco Rubio, who did much better than expectations. It's basically, in my mind, it's New Hampshire or bust. I know he might try and then go down to South Carolina, where he's got Lindsey Graham's endorsement. But right now, let's see how the ground plays out in New Hampshire. He polls better in New Hampshire than he does in Iowa. But the real question is if Rubio can get momentum coming out of Iowa. If Rubio finishes ahead of Bush, I think it probably is time for Bush to say, you know what, I made a good run, but it's time to go home to Florida.
You mentioned an endorsement there, and that's what some people are looking to now is the endorsement game in states like New Hampshire, in South Carolina, and Nevada coming up too. You track that at 538. What are you watching for the next major endorsements and whether they'll make a difference?
Well, you know, one of the things that has happened over the past few days is that Marco Rubio, we weight the endorsements, I should say, by how important the position is, so governors get more points than members of the House. And what we've seen is that Marco Rubio and his weighted endorsement total has now passed Jeb Bush, which isn't so surprising. He picked up the endorsements of Tim Scott, who is the junior senator from the state of South Carolina. He also picked up the endorsement of Pat Toomey, the Republican senator from the state of Pennsylvania. These are conservative people, but they're more mainstream conservative voices within the Republican Senate caucus. It's going to be very interesting to see if Rubio can get more of those, because if he can, it will be an illustration that maybe the quote-unquote establishment is rallying behind him.
Right. That's the phenomenon people have been watching for. Scott Walker called for it when he got out of the campaign, for everybody else to get out, one more establishment candidate to rise to the top and compete with Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. Is there a sense, if these endorsements start coming in for Rubio, that this is it, this is the time for that, maybe New Hampshire and beyond?
Yeah, I think probably Rubio would need to do better in New Hampshire to see a full wave. You know, Rubio would have to be the best of the establishment lane. But you can already see it sort of developing in the Iowa results. You saw Rubio did best among those who are somewhat conservative, which sort of is the mainstream of the Republican Party. You saw him doing best among those with college educations or better. Again, that looks like a Romney sort of path. And third, and very key, he did best among those whose most important quality was to be able to win in November. And I can tell you, those Republicans in Congress, they want to win in November. So if he can take that coalition that he won in Iowa and then apply it to New Hampshire, I would expect that after that win, if he does the best in the establishment late in New Hampshire, and then especially if he does best in South Carolina, there's going to be a wave of endorsements for him. And I think that that would be the coalescing of that establishment lane that we've spoke about so often.
And on the endorsements on the Democratic side, huge imbalance as I watch 538. Lots and lots of points, lots of endorsements for Hillary Clinton. Very few for Bernie Sanders. What would it take? What would we have to do in the next couple events to start getting people coming out and supporting him for the major Democrat elected office holders?
You know, one of the big problems is the majority of them have already supported Hillary Clinton. They would have to change their minds. I think if he wins in New Hampshire, and I think most of the polling indicates he has a large lead there, so that's almost expected at this point. I think you'd get a few more, but I would not expect any sort of wave. If he were to do very well in South Carolina, which is a state which is majority African-American, at least on the Democratic side, that might be a little more interesting. But again, almost all the endorsements have already come, and they've almost all been for Hillary Clinton. So it would take people reneging on their word for him to really make a run at getting any sizable number of endorsements on the Democratic side.
Before we're done with the Iowa caucus, Harry, I saw a young, engaging journalist at a Twitter video saying, "This is why Iowa caucuses stink." This was you. I should have pulled the audio.
I think I was able to figure that one out, but please continue.
So what is it wrong with the Iowa caucuses? Why is that a problem?
To me, I just don't like it. You know, you can claim which state you want to go first or second or last, and, you know, you can talk about the demographics. I just don't like the idea of a voting taking place at one particular time, taking a lot of time, and on the Democratic side, it's not even the person who necessarily gets the most votes wins with the differences between statewide delegate equivalents and actual raw vote. I think voting should be open. It should be easy. It shouldn't take that much time. And Iowa is the exact opposite of that.
Harry, thanks as always.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. Farming has long been a vital part of our state's history, culture, and economy, but the average age of a farm operator in Wisconsin is 54 and a half years, and our state is seeing a continuing decline of family-run farms.
In an effort to encourage young people to consider farming as a viable career, a Wisconsin state representative has introduced the New Farmer Student Loan Assistance Program, which would help ease the burden of student debt for people who commit to operating a small or medium-sized farm in Wisconsin. We're joined now by the co-author of that bill, Mark Spreitzer, a Democratic state representative from Beloit. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, let's jump right in. Can you give us the core of this program that you're proposing? What would it do?
Absolutely. This program would provide student loan assistance to new farmers. They would have to apply for the program and be accepted based on having financial need and based on their preparation for farming in Wisconsin, their commitment to farm for at least 5 years and hopefully make a career out of it, and some other criteria, including the use of sustainable best practices as a preference within the application process. And if they're accepted, they would be reimbursed over a period of 5 years for up to $30,000 worth of student debt. And that could be from a bachelor's degree, an associate's degree, or the farm and industry short course at UW-Madison. And the whole idea of this is to make sure that during those 5 years that they're getting started farming, that they're not having to worry about making monthly loan payments, and they can focus on trying to get their farm economically self-sufficient and make those investments to pursue that career, because farming's often not that profitable in those early years getting started. And I wanted this to be as broad as possible in terms of who can participate, so it's really geared both toward people who grew up on a farm and are going back to either take over the family farm or strike out on their own, as well as people who grew up in a city or the suburbs and decided they wanted to get into farming and are doing that for the first time.
Why are you zeroing in on the student loan angle of it instead of, say, just offering incentives for anyone who wants to be a new farmer?
For two reasons. One is there are a number of programs that are available already to help with the purchase of land or equipment or other kinds of expenses related to getting started with farming, but there's not anything like this that relates to student debt. And the other issue is that we're seeing farming becoming more technical, so more farmers really need to go and get an education. And also we're seeing a real interest in people who didn't necessarily go to school for farming but have gotten interested in agriculture, and a lot lot of times might major in something related to business or marketing and are trying to figure out how to add value to their farm crops and really make it as an entrepreneur. And so they need to get an education and they have student debt. So I wanted to tackle that issue.
Do you think that $30,000, up to $30,000, is enough to incentivize young people to go into farming at all?
Well, clearly, somebody needs to have an interest in farming and have other supports in place for this to work. But the average student debt for somebody graduating from the UW system with a bachelor's degree is just over $30,000. For somebody graduating from a private college in Wisconsin, the average debt is about $32,000. So we picked that number because that really tracks with the average debt. And the whole idea here is just to take that away as one of the barriers that is preventing people from going into farming if they already want to do that.
Right. And have you talked to people on the ground who said, yeah, I would like to go into farming, but I've got this loan burden and I'm not sure about the profit margins? Do you think this would solve what you're hearing from real people?
Absolutely. I know people that I went to college with at Beloit College that are in Wisconsin trying to get started in farming and navigating the challenges and making that work financially while paying off their debt. I've talked to one of my constituents, Jacob Marty, who luckily got out of college without student loans, but has talked to me about people he went to school with at UW-Stevens Point who would love to be farming and aren't because of their student debt. And he's in the process of taking over his parents' farm and succeeding at that, but wants to see his friends be able to do that as well. So I've met a number of people that are either paying off loans or know people who are and that are seeing this as a real issue that would help them.
We're talking to Mark Spreitzer right now, a Democratic state representative from Beloit, talking about a new program which would help ease the burden of student debt for young farmers in the state that he has created and is looking at right now. And you hear a lot about how the farming landscape has changed. The consolidation of farms, big agriculture, has made it harder for individual small-scale operations to thrive, to get off the ground, to keep solvent. How would this help that aspect of all of it?
Well, there are a couple of pieces of that. One is that if somebody who is a farmer that is aging and is preparing to retire and they don't have somebody to pass that farm along to, they don't have kids or other family members that want to come back and take it over and haven't been able to connect with another young person that wants to take it over, there's a real risk that farmland ceases to be a family farm and it might become part of a larger corporate operation, or it might stop being farmland at all, but it's not going to be a family farm anymore. And so bringing in more young people and giving them the tools that they need to succeed financially in farming is going to help to make sure that there's more opportunities to transition farms from older farmers who want to pass them on to somebody who is going to keep farming on the land. And the other thing we're seeing is just a real diversity of the kinds of farming people are doing. And as I mentioned, a lot of interest in local food and trying to add value to those products and sell them at farmers markets or as part of community-supported agriculture programs. And a lot of the people doing that have gone and gotten college degrees in a variety of areas and are finding ways to be entrepreneurs, and helping with that student debt issue is, I think, really going to encourage that.
You've mentioned that you want to target people who sort of have an in with farming to begin with. Maybe it's in their family already and you want to incentivize them that way. But what about people who don't come from farming backgrounds? Do you think that this might give a little enticement there too?
Absolutely, and that's why there's no requirement that somebody needs to have gotten their degree in an agriculture-related field or come from a farming background. The goal here is really to bring in people from diverse, both farming and non-farming backgrounds, and we want to make sure that they've done some preparation to succeed in farming, and so the program will be able to look at whether they've gotten some education related to farming or whether they have a farmer mentor or a business plan, things like that, so that we're really helping people who have a good chance of success, but they don't have to come from a farming background. And I really hope that people will take advantage of this who didn't grow up on a farm and are interested in getting into that, because we need new farmers from wherever we can get them.
So what's next for this bill? And do you have any bipartisan support on board.
The bill does have bipartisan support. It has four Republican co-sponsors in the Assembly, which I'm very excited about. The bill has been officially turned in for introduction, and I'm just waiting right now for it to be referred to committee, and I hope that it will get a public hearing. So looking forward to that process, hopefully in the next week or so here. And things are moving very quickly in the legislature right now toward the end of our session, but I've heard some good support, and as I said, four Republican co-sponsors. So I'm very hopeful that when this is referred to committee that we'll have a public hearing and a chance to move it forward in the process.
So if this has some success, are you optimistic that it could change the outlook for farmers in Wisconsin?
I do. I think this can be one part of the solution. This is partially modeled after a program that already exists in the state of New York, and they've seen a lot of interest in applying for the program that they have there, and I think we can make that work in Wisconsin as well. And I've also built into the program an audit by the Legislative Audit Bureau as it goes forward so that we can see what's working and what isn't. And my hope is we'll see that it's working as funded at this level and be able to expand it and put some more money into it going forward based on that success.
Representative Spreitzer, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Mark Spreitzer, Democratic State Representative from Beloit. We've been talking about his new proposed program that would help ease the burden of student debt for young farmers in Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up in just a few moments, homicides in Milwaukee were up last year. We'll try to get a handle on why that was and what's being done to try and reverse the trend in the coming year.
First, a Facebook comment posted by Superior's mayor over a month ago calling President Obama a Muslim ignited a conversation about cultural misunderstandings and race in the Twin Ports. As Danielle Kading reports, people gathered for a forum in Superior to talk about how preconceived notions affect the way people interact with one another.
Police department, please come to the door.
Oh, now it's going to happen. Look what you did.
Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander is standing in a circle with Laura Gapsky and Josiah Madison. They're taking part in a role-playing session to demonstrate how misunderstandings exist between races and cultures. The three are acting out a police call to a domestic dispute between Gapsky, a white woman, and Madison, a biracial man. Tim Davis is the group's facilitator.
We have Laura! She's yelling. She's frustrated. This is a what? Cultural biases and misunderstanding. Generally what happens? You're going to get arrested.
In this scenario, Davis argues Madison would most likely be arrested because of his skin color, even though who's at fault may not be immediately clear. Superior's police chief says gender also plays a part in people's biases.
It's typically the male who's at fault.
Alexander became Superior's police chief a little more than a year ago. At the time, a white police officer had just been cleared of charges he used excessive force during the arrest of a black woman. He's been working to address cultural and racial divides between police and the community, but he says it's not just law enforcement that needs a gut check.
I came in plain clothes today. I'm quite sure I would have been looked at by some people differently today had I come in uniform.
Josiah Madison says people sometimes draw the wrong conclusions, even when they don't mean any harm. He says that happened to him once when an older gentleman walked by him and his white older brother joking outside a gas station.
And he had seen him making a joke at me, and I started crying. So this man comes up, whatever he had seen, it's what he had seen in his perception, and he thought that he was picking on me as some random person. He was being racist towards me.
Douglas County District Attorney Dan Blank says the justice system is sensitive to racial or cultural disparities. He says they tried to treat everyone equally by looking at conduct, offenses, and fair consequences.
Unless you can put yourselves in the shoes of the minorities, you have no idea what it feels like and what is actually going on. The majority can't relate.
That's why Blank thought it was important to attend the forum.
I think it's a proactive approach, given what's happened nationally, and that's why I'd like to be at the table and a part of it, to be planning ahead and learning from others' mistakes or issues.
Superior's police chief says more education is needed. For example, Alexander says state law enforcement standards require recruits to receive 720 hours of instruction, but only 4 hours are devoted to cultural diversity.
You can't touch on a topic of that depth in 4 hours, so it's very generic, and it's more on just the generalities of treat everybody equal and fair. I mean, without touching into some of the subconscious things that are going on and how your decisions are going to be impacted.
Facilitator Tim Davis says education needs to start before any stereotypes take root. but he says everyone needs to work to better understand one another.
I think the problem becomes when being naive and being ignorant is an excuse.
Davis says it's important people challenge their perceptions now so they'll be able to see things from another point of view the next time a situation plays out in real life. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
'14 had one of the lowest recorded homicide totals in Milwaukee in a generation. But last year, the number of homicides in the city increased by almost 69%, a huge jump that has a lot of experts wondering why.
Stan Stojkovic is with us now to talk about these numbers, what could be behind the increase and efforts to lower that number in 2016. He's dean for the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. Stan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, these numbers, high homicide numbers in Milwaukee last year, a big increase over the previous year. Can you put them, though, in a longer-term historical context? What do those numbers say to you?
Well, it may be at one level statistically a blip. Homicide is obviously one of the more serious crimes, violent crime as measured by the FBI, but it is also one of the least common crimes. So when we start to predict and try to look at, all right, what's happening over time, you will see years where you'll get spikes in the behavior. The question that becomes problematic is what's causing that in a very short period of time. 12 months is not a long period of time to really look at this. So there's all sorts of speculation as to what's going on. But if you look at homicides over time, they tend to even out.
So what kind of explanations do people point to for homicides jumping up like that in a city like Milwaukee and other cities, Baltimore and others across the country, apart from the idea that maybe this was just a statistically bad year and it'll get better hopefully on its own?
Well, you know, we're in a context right now historically where the police are, you know, in some cases getting a bad rap, in some cases getting a justified rap. Police behavior and police misbehavior in particular is something that has drawn the attention of people across the country, particularly police who are the majority, who are Caucasian and white, and the victims ultimately are the offenders, maybe African-American or Latino, or disproportionately people of color. This question is being played out right now when we're seeing some really horrific instances where individual police behavior is called into question. So some people are saying, well, it's in response to this. This is the beginning of some kind of a trend. The problem with that is we don't have any evidence that that's necessarily the case. We don't want to wait for years to happen before we can draw that conclusion. But there are probably a lot of other factors as well that affect homicide rates. Again, least common serious violent crime, very, very difficult to predict or project.
Now that's the Ferguson effect. People have been calling it what you were just referring to. This idea, anyway, that in light of all the media attention to police don't necessarily want to put themselves in bad situations. And on the other hand, they get more pushback from the community when they do. But you say not really a lot of evidence so far to support that.
Yeah, in fact, anybody that's really looked at it in a very brief period of time, really you're talking in the last couple of years, hasn't come up with any conclusion that the Ferguson effect even exists. So there's some empirical questions about does this really exist, and is this the appropriate explanation? I tend to take a larger view and a more historic view that says the issue of homicide being concentrated in certain sections of the city disproportionately is not a new phenomenon. We've known this for over 80 years, especially in large cities. So the question is, how have we responded to these types of things, and what is an acceptable level of violence? I think most people would conclude any violence is bad, but we recognize we live in a very rough world, and we also have conditions under which many people live in communities of color that are just third worldish. They're not the kinds of places that most people are really aware of or familiar, and how that affects behavior.
One theory that's been going around, and there's some groups trying to work with this theory, is the idea of violence as a contagion, that once you start having acts of violence, it writes a script for people who are affected by it. They're more likely to be violent themselves or victims of violence. Treat this like a public health thing where you try to cut off that contagion. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, there is some evidence to suggest that if you look at this from a public health perspective, there may be some interesting kinds of things that you could do, either prevention or even after the fact. After the fact, in most people's minds, is too late. But I always go back to what I said earlier. I mean, we've known this for many, many years. many, many decades. I can isolate in the city of Milwaukee 6 to 8 zip codes that contribute disproportionately and have consistently for decades to violent crime, including homicide. So the question really becomes, what's the appropriate strategy to try to address these types of things? That's where it gets a little bit more murky. But I think people are being somewhat misled if they believe, well, we've got to isolate this thing because there's a public contagion. This has been a public contagion as far as we can go back in social science research. This is not a mystery. So my sense is that we're long on initial explanation, short on prevention, short on intervention.
Another long-running theory is the idea that maybe these zip codes you just mentioned, these high crime, high violent crime areas, it's a story about poverty, low resources, bad access to education. Again, this is one that's been talked about for decades and decades now. Do we think that's true?
Well, I think that there's some evidence to suggest that, you know, the relationship between the conditions under which people live and ultimately violence, it's there. Whether it's causal, that's a whole different matter, and scientists and, you know, people who are looking at these kinds of things are very, very, very cautious in drawing that kind of inference. Yet you cannot diminish the fact that disproportionately the people who are killed in large urban centers tend to look like they're perpetrators. They tend to be young, they tend to be disproportionately persons of color, and they tend to be male. And that has always been the case. So the question is, well, what are we doing with young, let's say, African-American or Latino males in the city of Milwaukee that, and the conditions under which they live that perpetuate these kinds of things? And you know, remember, our solution here goes way beyond criminal justice responses about police acting better or more efficiently. Those are some questions that may be important initial questions. The larger questions are much more difficult to answer. Things like employment, things like meaningful existence, connections to schools, connection to church, traditional social institutions that buttress people and in some cases protect people away from violence. Those are the kinds of things that are much harder to resolve.
We're talking to Stan Stojkovic now from UW-Milwaukee about the big increase in the number of homicides in Milwaukee, some other urban areas around the country as well, in 2015.
And we want to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. What do you think is behind this increase in homicides in Milwaukee? And what do you think about the theory of the Ferguson effect? What do you think needs to be done to cut down on violence in Milwaukee? Call now at 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now about the increase in the number of homicides in the city of Milwaukee last year.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know been affected by violence, by a homicide in Milwaukee or anywhere in this state? What do you think needs to be done to cut down on violence in Milwaukee and other American cities? What programs, what efforts would you like to see put into place to make things better in the city? And do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you could post on the Central Time Facebook page. Stan, you've talked about some different possible solutions. The clear thing from what you're saying that I'm hearing is there is not one simple, easy answer to all of this.
No, you know, people want a panacea solution. They want a quick fix. Excuse me, but that's usually not possible. And in this kind of issue where it's very complex, you've got many people scratching their heads, reasonably so, saying, how best can we address this? You know, we want to get the violence down to, you know, anything. The goal, obviously, of zero violence is probably not realistic. But the reality is we can do things, but it seems to me that we have to be patient. But we also have to think about what are these larger conditions and what do we have to do politically to sort of, you know, make better decisions about the quality of life in these communities. Because oftentimes, again, the quality of life is not something that most people in America are aware of or would condone.
There's a chicken or egg question, though, with that, though. People say to get rid of violence, improve economic conditions, but other people are saying violence really makes it hard to improve economic conditions. Nobody wants to open that local business. People don't want to move into this area. People with the resources to get out, get out. So how do you, which side of that do you start on?
Well, you're right. I mean, that's a difficult question. I know Chief of Police in Milwaukee, Chief Flynn has said that for many years, that, you know, poverty doesn't cause crime, but crime causes poverty, and that there are problems in terms of maintaining existence. But, you know, these are political decisions, allocations of resources. We don't have a lot of resources. Most of these communities, particularly the city of Milwaukee, is financially strapped. How do we best use our limited resources seems to be the best question, and there is no easy answer to that question.
Now, when I think, and maybe I remember it wrong, Stan, when I look back at the higher crime times back in the 80s, when a lot of our modern crime and punishment practices were put into effect, people pointed a lot of the attention to the crack cocaine epidemic, to drug dealing gangs, things like that. Do we see, is that part of the story now or no?
Well, it depends, you know, depending upon the community. The whole issue in the 80s and many larger communities dealt with crack cocaine and trying to deal with crack cocaine and how do we deal with the violence around crack cocaine. That issue is no longer an issue. You started to see stabilization of crack markets in the early 90s. Violence went down. But violence has gone down since the early 90s precipitously and significantly. And there are all sorts of explanations that criminologists, sociologists, political scientists, individuals offer, but we really don't have a definitive answer because there may not be one. People's initial response is to get tough, you know, throw away the key on people. But we've done that significantly for the last 20 years. Our incarceration rates, you know, are second to none in the whole world. So we have to come up with something that's a little bit more fiscally prudent, but also can really address, again, I say, the conditions under which people live.
Talking to Stan Stojkovic from UW-Milwaukee about last year's big jump in homicide numbers in Milwaukee, some other American cities, and possible solutions that are being considered. You can join in at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Stan, if it's really just statistical variation, is it possible that we might spend a lot of time and effort trying to fix this problem and come up with nothing?
Well, that is a possibility, and of course, that's the, you know, $64,000 question, and the threshold questions are: how low do you want to go before it's not significant? Is 100 homicides okay? Is 50 okay? Is one too many? You know, those are tough questions because at one point we want to say no homicide is legitimate mm-hmm. or warranted, but we also have to place that in the context of fiscal realities. What can we do, and who can do the best possible job? There's no doubt it involves a criminal justice response, but it can't be solely a criminal justice response. They're not the sole solution to this problem.
I want to get into a couple other solutions that have been offered. The availability of guns in these high crime areas. Most of the homicides we're talking about, I think, in Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's reporting, something in the neighborhood of 80% of Milwaukee homicides were with a firearm. Again, probably not the only answer, not an easy answer, but is some kind of effort to restrict the flow of firearms into big cities part of the solution?
It could be, but you know, the fact of the matter is there are 300 million handguns in this country, almost one for every citizen, man, woman, and child. This is a gun culture, and there are consequences associated with that gun culture. Now, having said that, we can become more prudent, it seems to me, in how we utilize guns, allow people to access guns. Do they get the sufficient training? Most of the people who are committing crimes are not going to register for a license and take the appropriate courses. They're going to get guns on the streets. And a lot of gun legislation, therefore, really is not going to take it anywhere. The real question you have to say is, how do we address the laws that we currently have for people who use guns inappropriately? And again, I know Chief Flynn is really big on that here in Milwaukee, is saying that there are really no consequences for some people, young people who are using weapons, and using those weapons inappropriately.
Now, we've talked to groups, people with groups in Milwaukee who are trying to spread a message of nonviolence. They're organizing community groups to talk to young men especially. Do you think there's promise there with a really locally born, locally produced, locally focused solution?
Well, you know, I read about that, saw it in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s, and the 90s. Again, nothing new in terms of that solution. I'm not sure that it's not a panacea solution. Should we get people in neighborhoods talking about this and get the citizens involved? Absolutely. How we best do that is problematic.
Are you hopeful that 2016 is going to be a better year, Stan?
I don't know. You know, I mean, legitimately, I really don't know. I mean, there's so many conditions, again, and so many factors that affect that decision. You got to remember that people are shooting people for the absolutely craziest ideas. You know, and alcohol abuse is another significant issue. It's not only availability of guns, but alcohol abuse. Alcohol is an incredibly strong predictor associated with violence in this country, whether it's domestic violence or it's violence where there's, you know, lethal consequences. So those are issues that we have to deal with. We have to deal with that in the context of some political realities. You know, the state of Wisconsin is one that is very powerful and really loves its alcohol. And trying to limit or control or get involved in the abuse of alcohol, particularly when we know there are certain days of the week, certain times, where there's alcohol involved and people are shooting each other over girlfriends, parking spaces, and who's the best quarterback in the NFL. It goes way beyond the rational notion. And so any kind of solution on this issue is going to have to be very, very complex and not easy to implement. It's the nature of the beast.
What do you think of how Milwaukee's police department, as we wrap up, Stan, Milwaukee's police department reacted last year to this higher homicide number?
Well, I think that Chief Flynn, you know, and the Milwaukee police officers, excuse me, are trying to do the best they possibly can. And this is very, very difficult. My voice is cracking here. Not because I'm upset, but because I have cold.
Sure, a lot of them going around.
But, you know, the reality is they can only do so much. For them to be effective in the long run, they have to work with their communities. And I think trying to develop that relationship with communities is a central element of effective law enforcement as we go forward.
Stan, thanks a lot, and thanks for powering through the cold to be with us today.
Have a great day.
That was Stan Stojkovic. He's dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about the big increase in homicides in Milwaukee last year and various theories about why it happened and various ideas about how to solve the homicide problem. You may have noticed there's been lots of weather over the last couple of days. Snow, some places, sleet, slush, reports of some thunder snow. I heard some rumbling through the roof here. That wasn't the only thing going on out in the atmosphere.
Wisconsin got a look at something that looks like a vibrant fireball falling through the sky on Monday morning, and it was captured on videos released by the Muscadet Police Department, also by UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. The question remaining, what was it? Well, the best guess it was that this thing was a meteor or maybe possibly some space junk just streaking through the sky.
This was Monday afternoon at 6:30. I could have seen it. I was out and about. I did not see it. I wasn't looking in the right direction or something. And I checked on a calendar. We're not in the midst of any of those big meteor showers, you know, the Perseids, the Leonids. If it's a meteor, it's a loner of some sort. You didn't see it either.
I didn't see it either. It was interesting, though, to see the response for it. Most people thought that this was really cool that they had seen it. And I'm sure it was cool.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, I mean, it's a big sort of flaming object streaking through the sky. Uh-huh. I think if I'd have seen it, I would have been, at least for a moment, mildly alarmed, to say the least.
Like a harbinger of the end times sort of thing? No?
I don't know about that, but at least maybe a flaming ball heading toward planet Earth.
Yeah, it burned up. So we want to know if you saw it, by the way. We've got a link to the video of this fireball. This is the one from the UW. And the Muscadet Police Department has got it on their Facebook page, too, by the way. Check out that video on the Central Time Facebook page.